Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Daniel Sheehan. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Virginia Environmental Law Journal here at the law school. On behalf of the journal, I'd like to welcome you all to our fall symposium entitled Condemning Open Space. Dominion Virginia Power's planned construction of an electricity transmission line through scenic open space and historic lands in Northern Virginia is a topic of great interest and importance to Virginia residents and their local government officials and state and national legislatures as well. This symposium aims to offer a variety of perspectives on this controversial issue, with a particular emphasis on the possible condemnation of land, the conservation or historic values of which have been protected by a conservation easement. Our first panel of this symposium will run until 3:10, at which time we will have a 15-minute recess with refreshments in the lobby. The symposium will reconvene promptly at 3:25 with our second panel and run up until 5 p.m. We have reserved 40 minutes of question and answers at the end of the second panel presentation. Because each of the panelists has been given only limited time to present, we ask that you reserve your questions for the Q&A session only. Now I'm going to go ahead and introduce all of the speakers on our first panel. Our first speaker to my right is Professor Nancy McLaughlin. She's from the University of Utah S.J. Quinney College of Law. Mrs. McLaughlin received her J.D. from the University of Virginia in 1990. She is a nationally recognized expert on conservation easements and has published numerous articles on the subject. Her most recent article, Condemning Open Space, Making Way for National Interest Electric Transmission Corridors or Not, will be published in our journal in the spring of next year, and your handout is based in part on that article. Professor McLaughlin will be followed by George Freeman of the law firm of Hunton and Williams. Mr. Freeman's practice focuses on environmental, energy, and administrative law, and he was the co-author of Virginia's historic and open space preservation laws, which were enacted in the 1960s. Our next speaker on the first panel will be Fred Fisher, Special Assistant Attorney General for the Commonwealth of Virginia. As Assistant Attorney General, Mr. Fisher specializes in matters related to the Virginia Outdoors Foundation, which is the public body that acquires most of the open space conservation easements conveyed in Virginia. Mr. Fisher is also a graduate of the University of Virginia School of Law. Ms. Nikki Robner, Deputy Secretary of Natural Resources for the Commonwealth of Virginia, will follow Mr. Fisher. Before being appointed to her post by Governor Kane in 2006, Ms. Robner worked as Director of Government Relations for the Nature Conservancy and also as a staff attorney with the Virginia Division of Legislative Services. Our final panelist on the first panel will be Mr. Lynn Coleman, who is a member of the Board of Directors of the Piedmont Environmental Council, which is the nonprofit organization leading the fight against the proposed transmission lines. Mr. Coleman is also the founding partner of Skadden Arps Energy Practice and has served as General Counsel and Deputy Secretary for the U.S. Department of Energy. I will now turn the podium over to our first panelist, Professor Nancy McLaughlin.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for coming. Before I start, I'd just like to thank the Virginia Environmental Law Journal for hosting this symposium on what is a very important topic, both in Virginia and nationwide. And I want to extend a special thank you to Daniel Sheehan, the editor-in-chief of the journal, who has worked tirelessly all semester to put this program together. I'd like to set the stage for the panel presentations this afternoon by briefly explaining the concept of a conservation easement, the extent to which conservation easements in Virginia are, should, and should not be subject to condemnation to make way for electric transmission facilities, and a few of the policy issues that should be considered when contemplating the condemnation of easement-encumbered land. So first, what is a conservation easement for maybe the few of you out there who aren't that familiar with the concept? An easement is a partial interest in land that's conveyed to a government entity or a nonprofit conservation organization, typically referred to as a land trust, that restricts the development and use of the land, generally in perpetuity, for the purpose of protecting certain conservation attributes of the land that benefit the public, such as prime soils, open space, or wildlife habitat. Conservation easements have become increasingly popular as a land protection tool over the last several decades, and this graph illustrates the dramatic growth in the number of local, state, and regional land trusts operating in the United States, and that's the blue line there on the left. And also it illustrates the growth in the number of acres encumbered by conservation easements held by these land trusts. The green line on the right illustrates that as of 2005, over 6.2 million acres were encumbered by easements held by local, state, and regional land trusts. And that 6.2 million figure doesn't include the millions of additional acres that are encumbered by easements held by government entities or by land trusts that operate on a national level, such as the Nature Conservancy, which reported that as of 2006, it held easements encumbering an additional 2.7 million acres for a total of over 8.9 million acres encumbered by easements held by these land trusts as of 2006. Virginia has experienced similar growth in the use of conservation easements to protect land within its borders. This graph illustrates the growth in the number of acres protected by easements conveyed to the Virginia Outdoors Foundation, which is a state entity that accepts most of the easements conveyed in Virginia. And as you can see, the graph indicates that as of October in 2007, the Virginia Outdoors Foundation, typically referred to as the VOF, held easements encumbering over 400,000 acres of land in Virginia, or more than 1.5% of the total acreage of the state. And a significant amount of this growth has occurred since 2000, which is the first year in which Virginia offered generous state income tax credits to landowners who donate easements. So now let's turn to the potential condemnation of land protected by easements to make way for electric transmission facilities, such as those pictured on this slide. Well, pursuant to the Federal Energy Policy Act of 2005, the U.S. Department of Energy has the authority to designate certain areas as national interest electric transmission corridors. And on October 2nd of this year, the department formally designated the first two of such corridors, one on the East Coast and one in the Southwest. This map illustrates the location of the Mid-Atlantic Area National Corridor. The orange area indicates the critical congestion area, while the gray dotted areas represent the location of the National Corridor itself. 15 counties in Northern Virginia, which are located within this circle and are listed in the box here on the right, fall within this National Corridor. Now that the Mid-Atlantic National Corridor has been designated, public utilities may be granted the right under federal as well as state law to condemn land within the corridor for the purpose of constructing transmission facilities. And this, of course, has led to some questions in Virginia regarding the extent to which utilities could condemn land that has been protected by conservation easements. Some worry that land encumbered by easements, which by definition is largely undeveloped, will become a target for condemnation because of the political difficulties associated with locating large and unsightly steel towers supporting high-voltage transmission lines in populated areas. Others, however, believe that encumbering land with a conservation easement may actually insulate it from condemnation, and there have been reports of landowners in Virginia donating easements in an attempt to thwart potential condemnation. And these easements have sometimes been referred to as spite easements. To explore these issues, we need to know a little bit about the laws in Virginia governing the creation and enforcement of conservation easements and how those laws interact with both the state and federal laws delegating the power of eminent domain to public utilities. Before I begin, though, I need to explain that the construction and maintenance of large steel towers supporting high-voltage transmission lines is likely to violate both the terms and the purpose of a conservation easement. So a public utility wishing to acquire a right-of-way to construct transmission facilities on land that's encumbered by an easement will generally need to condemn not only the right-of-way with regard to the encumbered land, but also some or all of the rights restricted by the conservation easement, thereby freeing the land to be used in manners formally restricted by the easement. So now to the laws applicable to conservation easements in Virginia. Virginia has enacted two statutes that authorize the creation and enforcement of easements, the Open Space Land Act, enacted in 1966, and the Virginia Conservation Easement Act, enacted in 1988. The easements authorized under the Open Space Land Act are, not surprisingly, referred to as open space easements, and they are conveyed to certain public bodies. The easements authorized under the Virginia Conservation Easement Act are simply conservation easements, and they are conveyed to nonprofit land trust organizations. So let's start with open space easements authorized under the Open Space Land Act. The public bodies to which open space easements can be conveyed include state agencies, counties, cities, towns, park authorities, and soil and water conservation districts. However, most of the open space easements in Virginia are conveyed to the Virginia Outdoors Foundation, which has been determined by the Attorney General in Virginia to be, in substance, a state agency. And the VOF is governed by a 7-member board of trustees that are appointed by successive governors of the state for 4-year terms. Now, the Open Space Land Act doesn't say anything directly about whether existing open space easements can be condemned. The Act does, however, provide that no land encumbered by an open space easement can be converted or diverted from open space land use unless, number one, the public body holding that easement determines that the conversion or diversion is essential to the orderly development and growth of the locality, and two, property of at least equal fair market value and of greater conservation value must be substituted for the land that's converted or diverted. Moreover, and importantly for our purposes today, the Act also provides that insofar as the provisions of the Act are inconsistent with the provisions of any other law, the provisions of the Act are controlling. So how does this Act relate to both state and federal laws delegating the power of eminent domain to utilities? Well, with regard to state law, I think the answer is fairly straightforward. Even if state law were to grant public utilities the right to condemn property held by public bodies, such rights should not be exercisable to condemn open space easements, because such condemnation would be inconsistent with this conversion or diversion provision. And of course, the Open Space Land Act specifically provides that it controls over any other law. As Mr. Freeman, who was one of the principal architects of the Open Space Land Act, is likely to elaborate on in his presentation, open space easements were simply not intended to be subject to condemnation under state law. Instead, it was intended that land encumbered by open space easements could be converted or diverted from open space land use to some other public use only upon satisfaction of the conditions set forth in the Open Space Land Act. In other words, the mechanism for extinguishing open space easements to accommodate development and growth in Virginia was built into the Open Space Land Act rather than the eminent domain laws of the state of Virginia. So open space easements do not appear to be subject to condemnation under state law. But what about under federal law? Pursuant to the Energy Policy Act, once the Department of Energy designates a national corridor, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, can grant permits to public utilities to construct electric transmission facilities within the corridor in certain circumstances, including where a state has withheld its approval for such construction for more than a year. And a FERC permit authorizes the public utility to exercise the federal power of eminent domain within the national corridor. The Energy Policy Act can thus operate to preempt a state's control over the siting of electric transmission facilities within its borders. However, in apparent deference to states' rights, the power of eminent domain granted to a public utility under a FERC permit does not extend to property owned by a state. So the question is, are open space easements property owned by the state and therefore exempt from a public utility's exercise of the federal power of eminent domain? This is an important question, given that some of the counties in Virginia that fall within the Mid-Atlantic Corridor contain a significant number of acres that have been protected by conservation easements, as you can see from the chart at the right. So again, the question is, do open space easements constitute property owned by a state, which is exempt from a public utility's exercise of the power of eminent domain under a FERC permit? I think the answer to that question should be yes, at least with respect to open space easements held by state agencies, such as the Department of Historic Resources, or by government entities that are in substance state agencies, such as the Virginia Outdoors Foundation. First, if you were to look at the informational materials provided on its website, The Department of Energy offers state parkland as an example of property that is, quote, owned by a state. It can be assumed that the Department of Energy is aware that state parkland is often owned not directly by a state, but by a state agency or other instrumentality on behalf of the state. It can therefore be assumed that other forms of property that are owned by state agencies or instrumentalities on behalf of a state will also be considered property that is, in substance, owned by a state. And second, there are a variety of technical legal reasons why an open space easement should be considered property for purposes of this phrase, but I won't bore you with those as they're explained in the handout that hopefully you all have. I do, however, want to highlight that from a policy perspective, there's little reason to treat state parkland as property owned by a state and thus as exempt from a public utilities exercise of the federal power of eminent domain, but to deny that same protection to open space easements. Open space easements appear to be no less important to the state of Virginia than its parklands. As this graph illustrates, Virginia has been increasingly relying on open space easements to protect the conservation and historic values of land within its borders. Moreover, it's investing significant public funds in these easements through the state income tax credit program, the cost of which was reported to be $231 million as of April 2007. And of course, it's also expending funds through the considerable efforts of its public bodies, mainly the Virginia Outdoors Foundation, in negotiating, monitoring, and enforcing these easements. Congress excluded property owned by a state from the delegation of the federal power of eminent domain to public utilities in deference to states' rights and to protect property that is very important to states from the exercise of this power. I think it would be very difficult to argue that open space easements, in which the state of Virginia is investing hundreds of millions of dollars, are not sufficiently important to the state to warrant this kind of protection. So bottom line, open space easements held by state agencies or the VOF should constitute property owned by a state which is exempt from a public utilities exercise of the power of eminent domain under a FERC permit. That means that if a public utility wishes to acquire a right-of-way to construct transmission facilities on land encumbered by such an easement, it should first be required to obtain the consent of the state entity holding that easement. And the state entity can grant its consent only upon satisfaction of, number one, the conversion or diversion requirements in the Open Space Land Act that we've already taken a look at, and, in appropriate circumstances, the requirements applicable to fiduciaries of charitable gifts. And this, of course, is not an uncontroversial issue, but it's a separate issue that the panelists can debate on another day. It is discussed briefly in your handout, however. Okay, well, whether open space easements held by counties, cities, towns, or other more subordinate public bodies should similarly be treated as property owned by a state is not entirely clear. As explained in your handout, however, even if open space easements held by these entities are not treated as property owned by the state, and as a result they are subject to the federal power of eminent domain, something known as the prior public use doctrine may operate to preclude their condemnation. This doctrine essentially prevents property that's already subject to one public use, as open space easements surely are, from being condemned for a different public use unless Congress has authorized that condemnation either expressly or by necessary implication. So we've covered open space easements held by public bodies, but what about conservation easements held by nonprofit land trusts under the Virginia Conservation Easement Act? Although there's some ambiguous language in this act regarding condemnation, public utilities may well have the right to exercise the power of eminent domain granted to them under state law to acquire conservation easements held by land trusts. And public utilities will, of course, have the right to exercise the power of eminent domain granted to them under federal law to acquire conservation easements held by land trusts. Why? Well, because those easements are not property owned by the state. In addition, although there are a few cases in this area that look somewhat promising, overall, charities have had very limited access, or very limited success in the courts defending against the condemnation of their land. So, just to summarize, open space easements held by public bodies in Virginia are likely to enjoy a significant amount of protection from condemnation under both federal and state law, While on the other hand, conservation easements held by nonprofit land trusts are not accorded the same protection. And that brings me to a few of the policy issues that I think we should consider when we're contemplating the condemnation of conservation easements. First, I think we need to consider whether it makes sense from a public benefit or a policy perspective to protect land encumbered by easements held by state entities, such as the Virginia Outdoors Foundation, from condemnation, but to not accord similar or even any protection to land encumbered by easements held by nonprofit land trusts, such as the Nature Conservancy. I'm not aware of any evidence that easements held by state entities are of consistently higher quality than easements held by land trusts. And in fact, some land trusts are more selective than government entities with regard to the easements they'll accept as well as the terms of those easements. And studies have shown that land trusts are generally more effective than government entities in monitoring and enforcing the easements they hold. So in some cases, conservation easements granted to land trusts may actually be superior to those granted to government entities in terms of both the conservation values and the long-term protection of those values. Moreover, if we were to look outside the state of Virginia, the issue of whether conservation easements held by land trusts should be accorded at least some protection against condemnation becomes even more compelling, because most of the estimated 8.9 million acres that are protected by easements across the nation are protected by easements held by land trusts rather than by state entities. And given the strong public policy in favor of the use of conservation easements as a land protection tool, the enormous investment of public funds in these easements in the form of tax incentives, easement purchase programs, and the time that's being spent by land trusts in negotiating, monitoring, and enforcing these easements, it simply doesn't make sense to accord no legal protection from condemnation to easements held by land trusts. Now, I want to be clear that I am not advocating a blanket prohibition on the condemnation of easement-encumbered land. That would clearly be inappropriate because easements are of vastly varying quality. The conservation values on at least some of easement-encumbered lands is going to decline over time as conditions change, and there will inevitably be circumstances when the public interest warrants the use of easement-encumbered land for some other public purpose. However, I do think that when condemning authorities are assessing condemnation alternatives, they should be required to take into account not only the conservation and historic values of the encumbered land, which they presumably are already required to do under both state and federal law, but also the protected status of that land. Now, Virginia, of course, has adopted a somewhat unique approach to the protection of land encumbered by open space easements by providing that that land can't be converted or diverted unless the public body holding the easement determines it to be essential to the orderly development and growth of the locality. Well, it's not entirely clear what this means. Some might argue that the Open Space Land Act is overly protective of open space easements and that it will cause these easements to continue to be enforced, even though it's clearly in the public interest to terminate them and devote the land to a different public use. Others might argue that it's not protective enough and that public bodies holding these easements are likely to be influenced by the politics of the day to authorize conversion or diversion, even when it's clearly in the public interest to continue to enforce the open space easements. And still others might argue that the drafters of the Open Space Land Act struck the right balance. Given that developed land is generally not a target for condemnation because of the difficulties associated with locating things like transmission towers, prisons, sewage treatment plants in populated areas, and given that undeveloped land is a target for condemnation for that same reason, the presumably high hurdle for termination in the Open Space Land Act may be perfectly appropriate, because it puts land protected for conservation, for its conservation and historic values, on the same footing as developed land when it comes to considering condemnation alternatives. And by that I mean both are more difficult to condemn than undeveloped but unprotected land. And with that, I'm going to turn the podium over to George Freeman, who is one of the principal architects of the Open Space Land Act and the other provisions of Virginia law relating to conservation and historic preservation.
When I was a small boy, I once went out to a country church and I heard the minister say, "I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you. And then I'm going to tell you. And then I'm going to tell you what I told you. What I am going to tell you today is that under applicable present Virginia law, a perpetual easement in growth on historic properties or open space held by a public body under the Virginia Open Space Land Act cannot be condemned by another state agency or entity or by a public utility under Virginia law. However, an easement held by a charitable foundation under the Virginia Conservation Easement Act of 1988 can be taken by condemnation. I'll start with the first act because I was sort of there at the creation of it, and also on its implementation. The act was passed in 1966, and it took a while for people to get the message about easements, and we really didn't start getting easements until 4 or 5 years later, and they were sparse in coming. And we really didn't have any experience under the conversion or diversion clause of the Open Space Land Act until 1988. And in 1988, the Virginia Department of Transportation, the Virginia Historic Landmarks Board, the Virginia Outdoors Foundation, all acting within the Bilal's administration with the consent and approval of the governor and the Attorney General's office, agreed that the Open Space Easement Act affords the exclusive mechanism under Virginia law for the release of open space easements held by those agencies or any other public body as defined in that act. And I will tell you the facts of that first case. The first case involved the release, a request for release of a part of an easement by the Virginia Transportation Department presented to the Board of Historic Resources, which in those days was called the Virginia Board of Historic Landmarks, for release of 20 acres of a perpetual easement under the act on the old mansion in Bowling Green, Virginia. There, the Landmarks Board found that the existence of alternative routes for completion of the Bowling Green bypass that did not encroach on the old mansion property precluded a finding under the act that the old mansion route was necessary, in quotation marks, within the meaning of Section 153A of that Act. The fact that the old mansion alternative would cost much less than the other four alternatives was immaterial, and the board concluded that also that as a matter of public policy within its discretion, the precedent set by release of the act of the easement in the absence of demonstrable absolute necessity, to use a phrase, would break faith with the grantor of this easement and other easement holders in the future and undermine its whole easement program. Now, the basic facts about the old mansion thing were, first, it was one of the oldest houses in Virginia. It was built in the late 17th century. It was located on 110 acres immediately south of the little town of Bowling Green in Caroline County. It was a landmark on both the Virginia and federal registers. Also, the easement itself was historic because it was the first easement granted to the Historic Landmarks Board under the new 1966 legislation. There was another aspect to that case. The Bowling Green Bypass was a high-priority project that had been started in the 1960s. Part of it had been completed with federal funds, but as federal funds got less and less available to Virginia, it kept being, completion of it kept being postponed. So it got to the point, too, that when the state wanted to go forward again, the Secretary of Transportation of the United States could not make the finding that was requisite under the federal law to devote further funding of the project, because that law prohibited the destruction of historic properties. So the question, there was a double question there. Could it be condemned under state law, or could federal funds be used for it? Now, even if the state were to pay for it wholly, and that kind of carving it out to try to get away from the federal requirement was called segmentation. It meant you took the segment that Old Mansion was going to go through Old Mansion, and you just used dollars that you could earmark to the state, and they used the rest of the money for all the rest of it. But fortunately, we had another good precedent here in Virginia, and that involved Tuckahoe Plantation, and there the U.S. District Court and the Fourth Circuit held that segmentation was illegal under the federal law. So, also at that time, we had a governor who'd just taken office, Jerry Beliles, who had four great objectives for his administration, and two of them were get the highway system up and working, and let's be sure we're doing the right thing for historic preservation. And each of the 4 years of his administration were devoted to special concentration on each of those subjects. He started with transportation. He then came to historic preservation. And all this took place just at the same time. So the governor encouraged the agencies, and they were encouraged by the governor, to reach some sort of agreement on this, and they did. And they agreed that the only way that land could be released from the easement under Virginia law for any purpose of Virginia law was through that special finding provision of that act. As far as the second act is concerned, well, I'm about out of time, it was based on a model act of 1981 that was nationwide. It was a uniform state law, and it addressed a number of things which we didn't think needed to be addressed in Virginia, because at the time we had the authority under Virginia law, we thought, for private charities to hold these easements too. But the thing that really turned everybody against that act, but nevertheless it went into law, is that the developers persuaded the House sponsors of the bill to take out two provisions that the governor and the conservation organizations had proposed, and one was to make sure that the act was not thought to be necessary and therefore to invalidate easements that were already on the books. They took that provision out. They would have said, we're not doing that. And then, more important, for this purpose here, they took out the provision which would have provided a procedure for conversion or diversion for that was similar to the provisions under the Open Space Act. So that's where we stand today. The bar, however, has had to wrestle with this with the IRS. And as a result, a number of provisions have been put into the implementation, the easements that are drafted under this. And Fred will talk to you now, since my time is gone, about how that works. And when the utility or other governmental agency condemns the easements held by private charities, what they will have to do in terms of paying for it. I will say I have a paper that will be available to you at the end of the meeting that gives the details of this and copies of the necessary opinions and findings.
Good afternoon. I hope that you will get out of this talk three points. One is that the voluntary land preservation effort under the Open Space Land Act, as principally carried out by the Virginia Outdoors Foundation, is the main statewide effort for preserving open space and for combating sprawl. Secondly, that the values involved, both open space and economic, are really major. There is serious land and serious money involved in this effort. And third, that the effort is dependent on the principle that there will be no net loss of protected open space. Virginia was founded by people who wanted land. It has a strong tradition of property rights and an equally strong aversion to taxes and regulations. When the problems of sprawl became evident in the 60s, statewide zoning was not an option. The legislature came up with a creative solution in the Open Space Land Act. This enabled the Commonwealth to work with those landowners who were interested in protecting their land to give them a way to protect their land to achieve the goals of both. The land would be retained by the private landowners, but in a typical easement, they would no longer have the right to subdivide it or develop it. They could continue to farm it, to harvest their forest, or to use their land for any other purpose, accepting only what they gave away in the easement document. The protected land would remain privately managed and taxpaying. It would also remain rural. I'd just like to read a couple of the findings of the General Assembly from 1966. They sound very timely from what we're worried about today. They found that the rapid growth and spread of urban development are creating critical problems of service and finance for the state and local governments. That the provision and preservation of permanent open space land are necessary to help curb urban sprawl, to prevent the spread of urban blight and deterioration, to encourage and assist more economic and desirable urban development. The Act goes on to set out many values of open space that can be protected, and it does allow a temporary protection for a minimum of 5 years. But its main focus is on the permanent protection of existing open space as permanent open space land. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Virginia Outdoors Foundation procedures for conversion and diversion of protected open space land. First of all, those terms are not defined in the statute. But I understand from George Freeman that the drafters considered that conversion referred to changing the permitted land uses while retaining overall protection of the easement. Diversion referred to removing all open space protections from a parcel of land, and then in exchange for placing those protections on a replacement parcel of land. The focus of the diversion is on maintaining the same open space values, but from moving them from one parcel, which is needed for some public purpose, to another parcel. In either case, there must be no net loss of economic or open space value. All economic and open space value lost by the public from the conversion or diversion must be replaced with other equivalent or better economic and open space values. There are no conversion-diversion regulations. No regulations are needed because the statute are clear. The statute is clear. But, although the statute is clear, the determinations that must be made under the statute are not easy. These determinations must be made by the public body, in the case of the VOF by its Board of Trustees. The VOF staff has prepared guidelines for the process to assist the applicant. If possible, if the applicant and owner apply jointly, that could expedite matters, but if the owner is unwilling, the applicant must apply alone. The guidelines suggest two steps. First, the applicant must convince the public body that the change is essential to the orderly growth and development of the locality and complies with the local comprehensive plan. Essential means that there are no feasible alternatives. This is a hard test, and it's a hard test for good reason. It should not be easy to change easements in which both the donor and the public have an expectation of perpetuity. On the other hand, the statute does specifically provide a way to allow for a change in the location of the protected open space if that change is truly essential and there will be no net loss of open space. George has already explained that the fact that the open space is the least cost solution is not sufficient. The use of open space is always the least cost solution for any project, and that's why it's so essential that it be protected. How do you determine what is essential for the local growth and development of the community? Well, this is the responsibility of the public body holding the easement. I would think an applicant should certainly bring evidence that the local government thinks it's essential. If it's a national project, I think the applicant should present evidence that the national or the state regulatory body has found that it's essential. But the ultimate decision is by the public body. I'd note that the law specifies growth and development of the locality. It does not address projects of statewide and national interest, but I think the law has to be interpreted to deal with the problems that come up. The second step, which can be done after the board has found the proposed diversion essential, or it can be done at the same time, is to propose the replacement of the required open space land. This involves establishing the value of the land to be diverted and the value of the land to be substituted, and that the other tests are met. How is the donor's intent protected? The Act provides a different protection than CyPRE. Under the CyPRE doctrine, when the donor's intent can no longer be carried out, a court proceeding determines how the assets can be preserved for the public benefit and still carry out the intent as much as possible. Under the Open Space Act, open space is always worth protecting in the public interest, even if the particular values that it may have provided at one time change over time. It is nonetheless valuable. But when a change is essential, the Act provides a standard for making that change. The donor's gift is made under the terms of the Act. The Act is a part of the easement contract made between the donor and the Commonwealth. The donor's intent, as set forth in the document, easement document, is protected as provided in the Act. What about easements in a corridor? VOF is a part of the government of the Commonwealth. As a state agency, it must take into account the responsibilities of other entities that are also fulfilling public responsibilities. Its practice has been not to process or take easements to frustrate a planned public improvement. It routinely consults the VDOT 6-year plan prior to taking an easement. If a road change is planned for the area, the easement specifically allows that change. When Dominion announced its routes, VOF stopped considering easements in the route. VOF was pleased that the routes attempted to avoid existing easements. However, in looking at the maps, it found it had accepted an easement but not finished recording it or processing it. And so the staff brought that to the board for advice as what should be done. Dominion Power was represented at that board meeting. Dominion stated that it did not object to VOF's completing the specific easement and that it could work around it. thank you very much.
I'm just going to talk about two things briefly. The first is Governor Kaine's 400,000-acre goal. I'm going to talk about that because it provides a little bit of the context for how important this discussion is right now. And then I'm also going to talk a little bit about the governor and the attorney general's response to the designation of the National Interest Electric Transmission Corridor. First, the 400,000-acre goal. Governor Kaine is proudly, I think, following in the footsteps of Governor Belisle's and identifying the environment as one of his four most important initiatives. And by far, the most important piece of his environmental agenda is the 400,000-acre goal. He announced this in April of 2006. He said he wanted to protect 400,000 acres during his term. This is an aggressive goal. This is an ambitious goal. Prior to Governor Kaine coming in office, the average number of acres protected each year in Virginia was about 55,000 acres. So we have to roughly double that in order to get to the goal of 400,000 acres in 4 years or so. Last year was a great year. We actually did 93,000 acres. About 70,000 of that was Virginia Outdoors Foundation's easement. So they are by far the most important player in terms of acreage in Virginia, no question about that. Why we had such a big number last year is open to interpretation. I think that changes in tax credit law certainly had something to do with it. So it remains to be seen what kind of year we're going to have this year. The 400,000-acre goal, of course, means not only conservation easements, but also land acquisition for parks, wildlife management areas, state forests, local parks. We are talking here about any sort of land conservation that is permanent. So local governments have a role to play here. Private organizations have a role to play here. State agencies other than the Virginia Outdoors Foundation have a role to play here. The federal government has a role to play here as well. We have some national wildlife refuges that are adding land slowly in different parts of the state. All that counts towards the 400,000-acre goal. So it really is a joint effort. But again, the Virginia Outdoors Foundation is by far the biggest player in terms of acreage. So how are we going to continue this rate of doubled acreage every single year? What do we have to do to be able to accelerate that fast? Well, there has been the governor last year in his budget added some staff for some of the agencies that do land conservation. A significant amount of additional funding for the Virginia Outdoors Foundation, also some funding for the Department of Historic Resources, the Department of Conservation and Recreation, Department of Forestry. So that's part of increasing the capacity at the state level to do land conservation. But from my perspective, and I really am speaking personally here, I think it's also important that there be a diversity of holders, a diversity of choices available to landowners who want to conserve their land. So while the Virginia Outdoors Foundation is going to continue to be the biggest, the most important player in terms of acreage, I think, into the foreseeable future, it's also important that the other agencies and organizations that are able to hold conservation easements and are able to acquire land increase their capacity as well. And that is happening. The Department of Forestry is about to announce a new easement program. They hold a couple of easements under the Forest Legacy Program, but they're going to be taking donated easements now. We hope that the game department is going to increase its capacity to hold easements. Local governments as well. Local governments have exactly the same authority to hold open space easements as does the Virginia Outdoors Foundation. And they are doing so at an increasing rate. And part of the reason for that is, for the first time last year, Governor Kaine proposed in his budget some funding to match local government investments in purchase of development rights programs. So that's still a small program. We hope it's going to grow. We hope it's going to get as big as it is in, for example, Pennsylvania, where almost all of the counties have PDR programs. The reason they have that is because they're entitled to state money to match their own. We hope that in Virginia we're going to get to a place where a lot of rural localities have PDR programs. Right now we're at about 16 or 17, I think. Not all of those are funded. So that's a place where capacity is growing. Again, speaking personally, I think capacity in the private sector also must grow in order for us to be able to sustain this accelerated rate of land conservation. As Professor McLaughlin pointed out, private land trusts sometimes can be more selective. They can focus on a particular kind of land that needs to be protected. Landowners sometimes don't want to work with government agencies for whatever reason, so they ought to have choices to work with private holders. Land trusts at the private level can be agile and may not have the same kind of protections against condemnation that public holders do, but they can negotiate with the condemning authority and perhaps get other land protected. The provisions of the Open Space Land Act that we've been talking about, 10.1-1704, that every speaker so far has referenced, the conversion-diversion thing, what that really is it's not saying no condemnation ever. What it's saying is it's setting a very high bar. The holding authority, the VOF or local government, has to approve it, and there's a high standard for approving it. And it's also saying that there can be no net loss. So can private land trusts, through negotiation, achieve that same kind of no net loss? I think we can hope they can. Whether they'll actually be able to achieve that, we don't know, because there haven't been a whole lot of condemnations, thankfully, of conservation easements in the past. But obviously the reason that we're all here today is because we think it's more likely to happen in the future as the Commonwealth and the rest of the country begins to grow. So that's all I have to say about... Oh, one more thing I want to say about private holders of conservation easements. Just to add to the points that Professor McLaughlin made, they are very important. They're just as important from a conservation perspective to the state as publicly held easements. And remember that the state is making a significant investment in many of these privately held easements because of the tax incentives that are available. Those tax incentives do not discriminate among privately held and publicly held easements. The donor is still entitled to this tax incentive. So the state is making an investment in those privately held easements. And that's because they're just as important to the public as publicly held easements. So that's why these questions that we're talking about today are so important. Of course, the reason that we're here is there is a transmission line that has been proposed for Virginia, and there is a corridor that has been adopted by the Department of Energy in Virginia. It's in a number of states. You've seen the map. What I'm here to tell you is that Governor Kaine opposed the designation of the corridor. There have been a number of pieces of correspondence between the governor and the DOE. What I'm going to talk you through very quickly right now are the arguments that were made in a joint letter from the governor and the attorney general to the DOE during the public comment period prior to the final designation when it was just proposed. The letter acknowledges the need for adequate transmission in the Mid-Atlantic. There's no argument about that, but it opposes the federal government taking on a role in the siting of transmission lines in a state like Virginia. And the reason that we think that Virginia is in a good position to make its own decisions about transmission lines are as follows. First of all, we've had a lot of development of energy policy in Virginia in the past couple of years. Those of you who are engaged with the General Assembly are very well aware of this. We have a Virginia energy plan that was just released in September. It acknowledges the importance of transmission infrastructure. We had a major piece of energy policy legislation 2 years ago that called for the creation of the energy plan and required the energy plan to address transmission along with other infrastructure needs. We had the so-called re-regulation bill that passed last year. We have a state corporation commission that has set the precedent in considering transmission lines to consider not only the needs of Virginia, but also the needs of neighboring states. So for all those reasons, we've said, the governor has said, the attorney general has said, there's no need for the federal government to come into Virginia and take on a role because we're protecting our citizens and we are considering the needs of the citizens throughout the region when our process to consider transmission lines goes forward. In addition to that, this letter from the Attorney General and the Governor to the DOE argues that the DOE did not comply with the Federal Energy Policy Act of 2005 when it designated the corridor. It was a requirement of the Energy Policy Act of 2005 that prior to designating any corridors, DOE had to do a congestion study. And it had to do that congestion study in consultation with the states, and that did not happen. And so the Attorney General and the Governor have weighed in that DOE's process violates federal law, and I'll close by telling you that today Virginia is has submitted or is about to submit a petition for reconsideration to DOE of the designation of the National Interest Electric Transmission Corridor. This, of course, is the first in many steps. There's likely to be litigation at one point or another over the corridor in this state or another state. We don't know if the SEC will act on the transmission lines in time so that there is no federal consideration of these particular transmission lines in Virginia. A lot's going to happen between now and when we might get to a place where the federal law controls condemnation of conservation easements. It may happen the next few years, it may not, but it's great to have this academic discussion of what could happen in that case in the future. So thank you very much.
I'm Lynn Coleman, and I would think that on a Friday afternoon, a beautiful autumn day in Virginia, it'd be pretty difficult to hold a crowd, even one as learned and distinguished as this, without somebody starting a row. And I'm guessing that's why I'm here. I've heard very little that I disagree with so far concerning the law of Virginia and its implementation, the importance of easements to meeting public objectives, and the insistence in Virginia law and by VOF that if an easement under the open space law is going to be the subject of condemnation, a very high burden of proof must be met. So I want to talk a little bit about what is involved in this, if I can find the, oh, it's this tiny little thing right there. Let's try again. I did that. Oh, I'm sorry. It's different than Dad showed me. I want to show you some slides that will let you have a little clearer understanding of what we're talking about and why people in the Piedmont feel so strongly about this. These red lines here are the two routes that Dominion has proposed for construction of a power line. Earlier, they were talking about a route, best I can tell, it would have been up closer to Route 50, almost like a straight line between that point, the Meadowbrook substation, over here to the Loudoun substation. Now, if you look at all of these little dots, and these are somewhat difficult to say. These are historic sites in this area. They are many. This is land, much of which was surveyed by George Washington. It contains the five Marshall family homes, a number of Civil War battle sites, and a number of other sites where interesting things of historical significance occurred. This then adds historic districts in the shaded color there, and you can see that there's a fair amount of this area that lies in one of those districts. This adds to it information about Civil War battlefields. The darker blue, like this shade, is a battlefield, like there's Manassas, Brandy Station, and the up several up around Route 50. One coming just west of Haymarket, the Battle of Thoroughfare Gap, and there's a whole bunch of them along the old pike that went between from Warrenton up toward Gainesville. You add this
The green are the conservation easements, which have been granted by landowners, mostly to VOF, in that area. You can see, I believe it probably has the largest concentration of scenic easements in the United States. Here we add the agricultural and forestry districts. Those are the ones marked in sort of a gray color here. Well, excuse me, I wanted to go back to that. Anyway, as you can tell from that last slide, this is a highly protected part of the United States. And my way of thinking about it is it's been hard for Dominion to think of a worse place to try to build a power line. Now, this photograph here shows what one type of their towers would be. I think that one's 140 feet. This shows you what a typical utility pole would be. And significantly, here's the tree line. Okay? Some of this is down an existing right-of-way. But the towers will clearly be visible from many places. These are slightly out of order, but that makes the point that I wanted to cover with those slides.
You're hitting it backwards.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. Well, and where the proposed right-of-way abuts land covered by existing easements, Dominion does not take any additional right-of-way. Instead, they'll take down this, what they call, lattice tower and put up two tall single pole towers that will range from 145 feet to 165 feet. But you can see, from the standpoint of the perspective of the people in the area, it'll be far more visible than the existing tower, which to a degree is screened by the existing trees. This is what at the Manassas National Battlefield you'll be able to see in the right-of-way two of these attractive structures. This is one from the Remington historic area in the vicinity of where the Battle of Brandy Station occurred. And then this shows you, this is kind of the part of the line that comes down in mainly in Rappahannock County. This curving line right here is the Rappahannock River. And where the yellow is, that's where they proposed to put a 165-foot tower. The blue, 125 to 135-foot tower. And an awful lot of this will be visible from such sites as the Appalachian Trail or the Skyline Drive or just almost any hilltop in the vicinity. Okay. So that's why we're here. Let me just make one comment that our view is that the law is as been described here. There's a difference between Nancy and George over whether an easement under the Conservation Act, as distinguished from the Open Lands Act, could be condemned. I hope Nancy's right, but I fear George is. But there's no case that decides or really directly bears upon that, so that's yet to be determined. This is important public policy. It is wrong to think about this as a contest between something that's being done in the public interest, like building a power line, and the wishes of private landowners. What you have in Virginia and elsewhere throughout the United States is essentially a public-private partnership, where the government has passed laws by which the generosity and willingness of private landowners to contribute an easement and restrict future development on that land is encouraged by the government, both through enactments such as the open space law in Virginia and, very significantly, the tax laws of Virginia and the United States. The federal tax law requires that to be deductible, qualify as a deductible easement, it must be perpetual. And this process is one, in my mind, of equal importance, equal dignity with the process that a utility would go through in obtaining a certificate of public convenience and necessity. We should not think that the need to build a power line somehow or other takes precedence over protecting these other values that have been so important in Virginia and have been followed, and thousands of decisions made relying on them, certainly in the last 30 years. Now, the utilities basically persuaded the federal government, actually I think you can say they probably wrote and suggested to the federal government that they pass this provision that became Section 216 of the Federal Power Act in the as part of the 2005 Energy Policy Act. And there was really no hearings on this amendment that I am aware of. There was a separate vote on it in the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and the amendment offered by Mr. Dingell and Mr. Boucher of Virginia to strike this provision failed on pretty much a party line vote. This was before the Democrats had regained control of that committee, and there's almost no legislative history as a consequence. In my judgment, if you look at this piece of legislation, it is conceptually flawed. Now, the Natural Gas Act, which is very, very similar to the Federal Power Act, has had a provision in it for eminent domain since, I believe, 1941. Those lines are long. Some of them are thousands of miles long. Congress decided at that time you had to federalize the process. The state basically has nothing to do with it. It's the power of eminent domain comes from a federal statute. It may be exercised in either state or federal court. And there has not been substantial difficulty under that statute. For one thing, a pipeline is an awful lot different from a power line with towers like this in terms of its impact on an area. The legislation says that a utility who does not get the approval they wish from a state licensing authority, or a year of time goes by from the time the application was filed or from the time the designation of a corridor was made by the Energy Department, may obtain a right-of-way permit from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. That may be exercised in either state or federal court, and it provides that state practice and procedure will be followed. That language is copied from the Natural Gas Act, and that statute has been construed that you follow state substantive law as well as procedural law. However, the drafters of this amendment thought that that went a little too far. They said it's state practice and procedure. However, we have a federal definition of damages for what they call unjust compensation, referring to the Fifth Amendment. You get the fair market value, including applicable severance damages, an undefined term which I assume but don't know means something like damages to the remaining track, from which the easement is taken, of the property taken. Now, what about the situation of the landowner who already has an easement across his property and one of these somewhat shorter power lines on it, and Dominion proposes to build one that's, you know, up to twice as high, which will have a lot more visual impact? I believe it will be the position of Dominion that they've already damaged that land and that there's nothing more to compensate. I think that is a good reason for the commission to seriously consider turning such a proposal down. What about the situation of the landowner who owns a tract which is not currently burdened with an easement, but he's immediately adjacent to it? Again, I suspect the answer from the utility will be that landowner is entitled to no compensation. Now, if you ask any real estate agent or any builder in that area, you think there is a diminution in value of the property in either of those cases, they're going to tell you yes, and it may be quite significant. But what that would translate into would be that the people of that area would be bearing a cost and would not be compensated for it. My son at the University of Texas calling me. This is Friday. I can imagine what he wants. that's an inherent problem in the condemnation process and under the federal law or state law, frankly. He's still at it. The other big problem here. Oh, I'm telling you, I'm having to stop. We'll get to the poorer way that the Department of Energy has implemented this law so far at another time. Thank you.
We're going to go ahead and start with our second panel. Our first panelist on our second panel is Mr. John Smatlack. He's the Vice President for Electric Transmission with Dominion Virginia Power. Mr. Smatlack is a registered professional engineer in Virginia and has been an employee of Dominion for 29 years. Mr. Smatlack will be followed by John Echevarria, who is the Executive Director of the Georgetown Environmental Law and Policy Institute at the Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. Mr. Echevarria frequently represents state and local governments, environmental organizations, and planning groups in regulatory takings cases at all levels of the federal and state court systems. After Mr. Echevarria's presentation, Professor McLaughlin will turn to the podium to end the panel presentations with a discussion of the issue of just compensation. We again request that you hold your questions until the Q&A session, which will begin right after Ms. McLaughlin's presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Sheen. Good afternoon. I'd like to thank the Law Review and the organizers of the symposium for the opportunity to participate in this forum. Today, I'd like to offer you some background on Dominion's approach to planning, siting, and constructing transmission lines in Virginia. I would also like to reiterate Dominion's commitment to working with stakeholders, state and local governments, businesses and conservation groups, and individual citizens to develop the best transmission solutions. Dominion Virginia Power provides electricity to about 6 million residents in the Commonwealth. The company owns an extensive network of 6,000 miles of high voltage transmission lines, mostly in Virginia, but also in North Carolina and West Virginia. These lines, in effect, are the highways of our electric system and are a crucial component of our ability to provide affordable, reliable power. We take pride in our open, transparent, and methodical process for determining when and where we need to build transmission lines, with many opportunities for input from the public. We believe we go significantly beyond the statutory obligations to solicit public input and work with stakeholders before we file an application with the State Corporation Commission. We also support the State Corporation Commission's process for reviewing proposed lines, determining the final route, and approving construction. The SCC, after all, ultimately determines where and when lines are built. And the Commission's procedures also provide the public with many opportunities for input and comment. We make every effort when planning and siting new lines to avoid or minimize impacts on historic and scenic resources and on sensitive environmental areas. Our routing avoids conservation and open space easements whenever possible. We believe this is consistent with the statutory mandate that the siting of transmission lines minimize environmental impacts. We also maintain a good working relationship with the Virginia Outdoors Foundation and with local governments. Transmission infrastructure is an important component of our effort to meet the rising demand for power in Virginia. Peak demand in Dominion service area has more than doubled since 1983. On August 8, as the temperature soared to more than 100 degrees throughout most of Virginia, our customers demanded a record amount of energy, 19,688 megawatts. This was 300 megawatts above the 2006 peak and almost 800 megawatts above the 2005 peak. PJM, the Regional Transmission Organization, or RTO, predicts the peak in our service area will increase by another 4,000 megawatts by 2017. In fact, Dominion's service area will have the highest annual peak demand growth rate, approximately 1.9%, within the RTO's 13-state footprint during the next decade, according to a PJM report released in January. That's the equivalent of adding 1 million new homes to our service area. This growth is fueled by population increases. Virginia is home to 8 of the 100 fastest growing counties in the country. It's also fueled by the larger size of new homes and by power consuming amenities such as large flat panel televisions. But perhaps more importantly, the growth is driven by the Commonwealth's robust business climate led by the high tech sector. Although we're committed to conservation and energy efficiency, demand-side management programs cannot eliminate the urgent need for new infrastructure. Clear warnings come from the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, known as NERC. Under the 2005 Federal Energy Policy Act, NERC was given the authority to issue mandatory reliability standards for the operation of the nation's transmission grid. These standards went into effect in June. Violations are punishable by fines of up to $1 million per day. As this slide shows, NERC's 2007 long-term reliability assessment painted a dire picture of the state of transmission investment in the United States. It found that industry professionals ranked aging infrastructure and limited new construction as the number one challenge to reliability. And it urged state and federal authorities to work together to ease the transmission siting process and remove obstacles to construction of needed infrastructure. Section 56 of the Code of Virginia sets out in great detail the procedures and processes the Commission uses to evaluate transmission line applications. The objective of the entire process can be summed up in this way. It seeks to reasonably minimize the project's social and environmental impact. It makes sure that a proposed transmission project is sound from an engineering standpoint. And it seeks to ensure that the project achieves its goal of system reliability in a cost-effective manner. The process is designed to ensure that the public interest is considered and protected during every step of the SEC's review. Section 56 contains comprehensive criteria for such analysis, including clear justification of the need, evaluation of environmental impacts, the use of existing rights of way whenever possible, the project's potential to improve service reliability, its effects on economic development and growth, its impact on local comprehensive plans, and the best methods of installation. This is a tried and true process that has helped ensure continued service reliability throughout the state. Dominion supports this process and will continue to use it in the future. The SEC review process is also marked by transparency and multiple opportunities for public input. This includes acceptance of written comments from any interested individual, as well as the opportunity for public hearings, often in both the affected localities and at the SEC headquarters in Richmond. Parties with a significant interest in the proceeding can formally participate in the case as interveners, with a right to file testimony, respond to company testimony, call witnesses, and cross-examine company and other witnesses. The process culminates in the evidentiary hearing, either before a hearing examiner or the full commission. This provides a highly visible public forum for a full exploration of all the details of the case. The information obtained at these evidentiary hearings plays a crucial role in the commission's final determination. Once we have determined the possible need for transmission system improvements, we conduct a lengthy internal review to evaluate the problem, identify solutions, and develop a proposal that can be filed with the SEC. We believe that this process is both transparent and public, with numerous opportunities for public input. For example, when we believe a major project is needed, we define a study area and receive opinions, input, and information from property owners, local governments, businesses, and other interested parties. We carefully inventory constraints and issues affecting placement of the line within the study area, including historic and conservation resources and environmentally sensitive areas. As I noted earlier, every effort is made to minimize the impact on these resources. This map vividly illustrates the many factors we must consider when deciding the proposed route for a transmission line. This particular example is located in northern Loudoun County. On the map, historic districts are colored in orange. Agricultural districts are outlined in yellow. Floodplains are outlined in light blue. Open water is colored in dark blue. Open space easements are shown with black hatched lines. Subdivisions are outlined with black lines. Dense subdivisions can be seen on the right side of the map, large lot subdivisions in the center and on the left. There were no parks, airports, or conservation easements in this area. The bold green lines represent alternative route segments considered for a new transmission line. The bold pink line represents the Dominion preferred route for the new transmission line. You should note that some of the green line segments pass through open space easements. We discovered these open space easements after selecting these route options. We avoided these green route options in part because of the open space easements. We selected the pink route as the preferred route because it was the route that caused the least overall social and environmental impact in our view. It also did not cross any open space easements. That is, until we discovered one additional open space easement that we had missed earlier. We then relocated our preferred route to avoid that newly discovered open space easement in the area shown by the dotted yellow line on the map. This real-life example portrays how much we respect open space easements and how we make every reasonable attempt to avoid them. We also conduct public open houses within the project study area to give property owners and other interested parties the opportunity to gain more detailed information about our proposal and to gather input from them in a face-to-face setting as well. At the conclusion of the process, we are prepared to submit our application, including a proposed route, to the SEC for its evaluation. The SEC ultimately determines when and where transmission lines in the Commonwealth are built. These steps often go far beyond what we are obligated to do by law, but we do not view them as optional. They are part of our deeply held commitment to our customers and our communities. As I said earlier, Dominion is committed to providing reliable, reasonably priced energy to its customers throughout the Commonwealth. We take that obligation seriously. And we also take seriously our obligation to plan and operate our system in an environmentally responsible way, a way that minimizes impact on our natural resources and protects human health and safety. This also includes a deep respect for the Commonwealth's conservation and historical resources, and a commitment to minimize any disruptions that our transmission projects may cause for property owners and communities. To achieve these goals, we work with interested stakeholders in government, in the business community, in the conservation and environmental community, and we work with individual citizens. These steps to solicit and evaluate input from the public often go far beyond statutory requirements, but they are the right things to do. We respect our customers and communities, and we hope we've earned their trust. Thank you for the opportunity to participate in the symposium. I'll turn the podium over to Mr. Echeverria.
Is there a way I can turn this off so I won't be representing? Close enough?
Good.
As Dan mentioned, I am John Echeverria. I'm the Executive Director of the Georgetown Environmental Law and Policy Institute at Georgetown Law Center, and I want to thank Nancy McLaughlin and Dan for including me in this event. I particularly want to thank Nancy for her excellent paper, which is, in her typical fashion, lays out the basics and focuses us on the issues worth debating. I left out on the table earlier two reports that the Institute produced. One is called Kelo's Unanswered Questions, which discusses the debate over the use of eminent domain for economic development. It doesn't specifically focus on the tension between eminent domain and the use of conservation easements, but you might find it informative. The second report is called Property Values in Oregon, Measure 37, which looks, in the context of an ongoing debate in Oregon, on the effect of regulatory restrictions on land values. And you might find particularly interesting a bibliography at the end that collects a lot of studies that have been done on the effect of legal restrictions on land values and summarizes some of the recent work that's been going on that issue in the D.C. area. I think we've run out of copies of these, but if anyone is so motivated, they can ask me or Dan, and I'll be happy to send you a copy. I need to say up front that I'm not licensed to practice law in Virginia. Most of what I know about the details of the eminent domain process and the process for establishing restricted lands in Virginia, I've learned from Nancy in the last 24 hours. I don't have any particular views on where the line ought to go because I don't know enough of the merits of that controversy. I want to, because I'm going to say some negative things about conservation easements, I want to lay out my environmental bona fides. I spent 6 years working for American Rivers as its general counsel and conservation director. I worked for another 6 years for the National Audubon Society as its general counsel. For the last 10 years, I've run the Georgetown Environmental Institute, and in that capacity have represented in a variety of legal proceedings such groups as Natural Resources Defense Council, Environmental Defense, Washington Environmental Council, the Maine Audubon Society, the South Carolina Coastal Council, and I could go on and on. I don't make anywhere as much money as Lynn Coleman because I practice public interest environmental law. So I think my bona fides are secure. Having said that, let me say this. I am, very frankly, a skeptic about the utility and fairness of conservation easements. And although some of what I'm going to say about this is not directly relevant to the siting question before you, it certainly colors my perception of the issue. I think that conservation easements are a wasteful use of very scarce and valuable federal taxpayer dollars. The magnitude of the deduction taken for conservation easements routinely exceeds the value lost to the property owner as a result of the restriction. This has been documented very recently in studies by Jeffrey Michael and Cynthia Nickerson, other economists who've looked in a very rigorous way at the effect of conservation restrictions on land values in the D.C. metropolitan area. Beyond that, the approach of relying on private volunteers within the framework of a very expansive and generous federal and state conservation system to decide what lands they wish to conserve produces, in my mind, an irrational and what will prove to be environmentally unfriendly conservation plan. It does not produce comprehensive conservation. It invites holdouts who exploit the conservation efforts of their neighbors. And as Professor Jesse Richardson has repeated over and over again, it doesn't restrict the amount of development. It simply moves it around. Contrary to a statement that was made earlier the prior panel, I don't think conservation easements could help control sprawl. Indeed, I think they largely induce sprawl. One could make a case that the reason that a significant fraction of the federal workforce working in Washington, D.C., now lives in West Virginia is in part due to the very effective conservation efforts in Loudoun and Fauquier and other counties. I understand that there are some sideboards on these conservation efforts imposed by the Internal Revenue Service and by the Virginia Outdoor Foundation, but to my way of thinking, they're so lax as to provide no effective limitation on the ability of any individual landowner who wishes to take these tax benefits and preserve their land. Let me make a few brief comments about the federal legislation on energy siting. I did not follow that legislative fight, as I guess nobody else did in America, but I did follow very closely the debate in Congress in the aftermath of the Kelo decision, the New London eminent domain decision handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court in June 2005, which generated just an unbelievable firestorm in Congress. Shortly after the chair of the House Judiciary Committee declared it the most outrageous decision since Dred Scott, the House passed an essentially unanimous resolution decrying the invasion of people's moral right to do what they want with their property, that went on and on and on. But I was curious. I said, well, how in the world earlier that year had Congress passed federal legislation which had basically federalized the power of eminent domain and increased the power of utilities to use eminent domain? And I had an interesting conversation with an electric power utility lobbyist who said, well, it was the culmination of a 10-year effort to achieve our fondest wish. We were jealous of the natural gas producers. We wanted to get as much of the same authority as we could, we succeeded in getting into that legislation. And the best part is when the final bill was debated on the floor of Congress, not one person said one thing about the bill and from that point of view, that was ideal. One of the ironies we now face is that the likelihood of any movement to restrict the use of eminent domain for economic development is inevitably going to be tied to any effort to restrict the use of eminent domain by the electric utilities, providing what's probably a perfect case of complete gridlock in Congress on this issue. Let me, in the time that remains to me, walk through with you the way I think about the issue of this Dominion power line, and I'm not talking in specifics, but in a very abstract way. I understand there's a debate about the need for the power line and the avoidability of the power line, whether there are conservation measures that could be taken that would obviate the need to create new transmission capacity. And obviously, if it were possible to not build this line, not only would it avoid the adverse effects of the line, but it would eliminate a whole lot of other adverse effects associated with additional energy legislation. I don't know the technical features of that debate and can't comment on it. And obviously, if we could avoid building the line, it would be better. But I'm going to proceed on the assumption, which may or may not be accurate, that additional transmission capacity is needed. The second step in my analysis is to say, well, it seems to me to make the most sense, everything else being equal, to use existing transmission corridors. I understand that that creates an additional impact. It may, I would think, have an adverse impact on the burden property owners. I think there are equity issues if those who got saddled with a transmission line get saddled over and over again with additional capacity, but everything else being equal and taking all the considerations into account, it seems to me that the public is better served by concentrating the impacts of transmission lines and thereby minimizing their overall impact by putting new lines where existing lines exist to the extent possible. Having said those two things, the question is, where should a transmission line go? Now, this conference is entitled Condemning Open Space, a very provocative title, and the focus here is, should open space be condemned? But if you accept my prior two premises, the question is, where will the line go? And if we're not going to put it on open space, do we put it on, well, say, Till Hazel's land, or do we put it on somebody else's property? And the question is that there has to be a choice made as to that. Whose ox is going to be gored, and to what extent do those who have pursued conservation easements and who live on land subject to conservation easements, to what extent are they entitled to a privileged position in the decision-making over whether or not to site a transmission line? Now, I understand and recognize that those lands subject to conservation easements often have important conservation values. They provide open space. At the same time, I think it's fair to say that the quality of those lands varies a good deal. For the reasons I said, there's not a very effective filter either at the federal or state level in terms of discriminating between lands worthy of conservation and those not. The lands tend to be discontinuous. Lynn Coleman had a slide which I thought was quite telling, was sort of an ink blot of green spaces around the map. So that the level of protection is not necessarily very comprehensive, and in addition, easements are so scattered all over the landscape, they could potentially, if they served as a trump to a transmission line, could block about any line anywhere. Now, what is the effect of putting a transmission line on a conservation easement? Well, obviously, it affects those conservation values, and perhaps most importantly and most particularly, it affects the owner or the farmer who lives on the land subject to the easement. Now, Nancy made the asserted that lands subject to conservation easements are equivalent as a matter of policy to public parks. And although I agree with so much of what Nancy says, I want to take issue with that because I think there's a fundamental difference between a park that's owned by the public, that's managed by the public, that's used by the public, and private land that's subject to a conservation easement. Parks represent a much larger public commitment. They involve actual public use and involvement and access, typically a much greater community investment in the park. And then, frankly, they're just less frequent. They're less numerous than conservation easements. And so a public policy designed to protect parks, as we protect parks from highways, so we should protect parks from transmission lines. Conservation easements, it seems to me, don't deserve the same level of protection. I think it's an interesting question whether the federal legislation dealing with that says that land, the property owned by the state, is not subject to the federal override. It seems to me at least debatable, or more debatable than Nancy suggests, that what Congress was referring to was fee-owned state lands, not privately owned lands that are subject to some kind of state-owned easement. For the legal wonks in the audience, it seems to me there is at least some statutory ambiguity in the federal legislation. And, for example, the Department of Energy might be within its rights to go through a rulemaking to try to interpret the meaning of the word property, and based on an exhaustive analysis and full public consultation, could probably justifiably reach the conclusion that that legislative term refers only to fee-owned properties. So that's easement, eased properties. Let me focus secondly on lands that are regulated, where not all development is outlawed, but where development is restricted in order to preserve open space values, such as Loudoun County's efforts to preserve the western part of the county. How should we think about easements that cross that kind of property? Just as with lands subject to a conservation easement, the transmission line can adversely affect the open space values, can adversely affect the owners in those lands subject to the conservation easements. But it seems to me the difference between the lands subject to conservation easements and those subject to a comprehensive regulatory regime is that the particular conservation regulatory regime is really more a legitimate product of a community democratic process in which there's a full and open debate about what kinds of restrictions ought to be imposed, and the restrictions that are put in place on a comprehensive basis. I would argue that a federal override of a community decision to put in place a comprehensive regulatory system is, in a sense, more offensive than the decision to override individual landowners' decisions to voluntarily put their land under conservation easement. And then there's the final category, which is lands. And by the way, I'm not even going to talk about lands that are developed, because I don't think Dominion Power is targeting developed lands. I think lands that are built upon, that have commercial development, that have dense residential development, are not part of this debate. We're talking about vacant lands of one kind or another. And so we have, typology, we have eased lands, lands subject to regulation, and then finally we have vacant lands which are not eased and not regulated specifically for their open space purposes. I guess this is the Till Hazel property. And is that where we ought to put all the transmission lines? Well, if our policy is to impose restrictions and impose conservation easements in order to protect lands from development, then presumably where we want the development to occur is in the third category of lands. That's where we want communities to be established. That's where we want homes to be built. That's where we want people to have backyards and to raise their children. If you put all the transmission lines in those communities, I think you could make the case that a larger fraction of the population is going to be impacted by imposing development in those lands than in the first case. I understand there may be political opposition, but simply in terms of policy, it's not clear to me that that's obviously a preferred site. So where do I come out on all this? I'm not saying that land subject to conservation easements ought to be a free fire zone for the establishment of transmission lines. I'm not sure I'm even prepared to say that they're not entitled to some higher level of protection, but I do think it's a very difficult question, and I'm not prepared to say that I would not endorse what I guess is the policy of Virginia to basically say that land subject to conservation easements are off limits unless hell freezes over. So what's the solution? I do think there's a role for the national government in overriding parochial, state, and local obstacles to the establishment of necessary transmission lines. I don't think organizations at the state level, like the Virginia Outdoor Foundation, which of course is committed to the preservation of easements, ought to be deciding when those restrictions ought to be lifted. At the federal level, God forbid that we assign this authority to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, as Congress has done. I've had a great deal of experience with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and it's the least publicly responsive agency within the federal bureaucracy. So I have a solution. My solution is that we assign this responsibility based on criteria yet to be developed to the Secretary of Interior. It seems to me that based on her statutory responsibilities and background, the Secretary of Interior is the best positioned to make the delicate balancing required to figure out how to balance the interests and at the same time ensure that we have necessary transmission services, assuming they in fact are needed. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm just going to ask you to bear with me for 20 more minutes and then we'll open it up for questions. Going to switch gears pretty significantly now, and what I want to address is the issue of just compensation, or as you can see from the slide, who should receive what when land encumbered by a conservation easement is condemned. This issue is of particular importance now, I think, because we're starting to see across the country the condemnation of land encumbered by easements. And at least in my experience, there is enormous confusion out there regarding the compensation that should be payable to both the owner of easement encumbered land and the holder of the easement upon condemnation. And some landowners and some condemning authorities are claiming that the holder of a conservation easement should receive little or nothing in the form of compensation upon condemnation. And obviously that would be disastrous from a policy perspective, because if holders of conservation easements are not appropriately compensated upon the condemnation of the land, then the conservation and historic benefits in which the public has been investing hundreds of millions of dollars, both at the state and the federal level, that investment is going to be lost. And easement encumbered land, which is already somewhat of a target for condemnation because it's undeveloped, it will become an even more attractive target for condemning authorities because it would be cheaper to condemn than land that has its development rights intact. So my goal this afternoon is to give you basically a crash course in 20 minutes on this particular subject to hopefully clear up this confusion and to ensure that holders of easements and by extension the public aren't shortchanged when land encumbered by an easement is condemned. And to put this in words used by the other panelists, I want to ensure that there's no net loss from a conservation perspective when easements are condemned. Whenever you're confronting an issue involving eminent domain, the starting point is the United States Constitution, and in particular our Takings Clause in the Fifth Amendment, which prohibits the taking of private property for a public use without just compensation. The 14th Amendment applies this obligation to the states, and it's now well settled in every part of the country that when private property is taken by eminent domain, the owner of that property is constitutionally entitled to just compensation. When land encumbered by a conservation easement is taken or condemned, two principal questions are presented. First, does the conservation easement constitute compensable property, as that term is defined for eminent domain purposes? And if the answer to this question is yes, the second question is, well, then how should we value that conservation easement for purposes of compensating the holder? Well, turning to this first question, does a conservation easement constitute compensable property? The short answer to this question is yes. Under any reasonable interpretation of the Fifth Amendment, a conservation easement should be treated as compensable property for eminent domain purposes. The meaning of the term property, as used in the Takings Clause, has evolved over time to encompass a wide variety of intangible rights or interests in property. The Supreme Court confirmed this expansive view in a 1945 case, U.S. v. General Motors, where in determining that a lessee's right to occupancy constituted compensable property for eminent domain purposes, the court explained that the constitutional provision, our Takings Clause, is addressed to every sort of interest a citizen may possess. So what does this mean? It means that for eminent domain purposes, compensable property includes intangible rights in real property, such as leasehold interests, interests of mortgagees, life estates, remainders, reversions. It includes traditional affirmative and negative easements, whether they're held appurtenant or in gross. And in a majority of states in the country and in Virginia and at the federal level, it also includes restrictive covenants or negative restrictions on the development and use of land, which of all property interests are most closely analogous to conservation easements. So bottom line, a landowner who conveys a conservation easement to a public body or a land trust is essentially dividing ownership of his or her land, and upon condemnation of that land, both owners should be entitled to compensation for the value of their respective interests. So the real issue in this context is not whether a conservation easement constitutes compensable property, but how the easement should be valued for purposes of compensating its holders. The various state and federal statutes that we have do not answer this question. The Virginia Conservation Easement Act provides that in any eminent domain proceeding, the holder of the conservation easement should be compensated for, quote, the value of the easement. But the Act doesn't explain how that value should be determined. The Open Space Land Act provides that upon conversion or diversion of land subject to an open space easement, the public body must receive substitute property of at least equal fair market value to the land converted or diverted. But this provision doesn't indicate how it applies to conservation easements, which are partial interests in land. And the Federal Energy Policy Act provides that upon the condemnation of a right-of-way for the construction of transmission facilities, just compensation shall be an amount equal to the fair market value, including applicable severance damages, of the property taken. This provision addresses how the total compensation award should be calculated. It does not address how that award should be apportioned between the various owners of interests in the affected land. So we need to look at general eminent domain principles to answer our valuation question with regard to easements. The first principle is simply the meaning of just compensation. The normal standard applied in determining just compensation for the taking of property is the property's fair market value, defined as what a willing buyer would pay a willing seller in an open and competitive market. But fair market value is not an absolute standard, and where property is not bought and sold in an open and competitive market, other valuation methods are employed. As explained by the Supreme Court in another case, U.S. v. Commodities Trading, when market value has been too difficult to find or an application would result in manifest injustice to owner or public, courts have fashioned and applied other standards. Whatever the circumstances under which such constitutional questions arise, however, the dominant consideration always remains the same. What compensation is just, both to the owner whose property is taken and to the public that must pay the bill? And the court in this case went on to provide that the word just in the Fifth Amendment evokes ideas of fairness and equity. And considerations of fairness and equity permeate court opinions regarding what constitutes just compensation. Well, now that we have a little bit of background regarding the meaning of just compensation, it's useful to consider how other non-possessory partial interests in land, such as traditional easements or restrictive covenants, are valued for eminent domain purposes. Traditional easements and restrictive covenants, they are not typically bought and sold in open and competitive markets. So, fair market value, generally not the appropriate standard to be used to value those interests. Not surprisingly, the courts have applied a different method, known as the before and after method, to value these types of interests. And under the before and after method, when land subject to an easement or a restrictive covenant is condemned, the holder of the easement or the covenant is generally entitled to the difference between the fair market value of the land immediately after the condemnation, free of the easement or the covenant restriction, and the fair market value of the land immediately before the condemnation, subject to that easement or covenant. So now let's apply these concepts to the valuation of conservation easements. Conservation easements, not bought and sold in open and competitive markets. So when land encumbered by an easement is taken, fair market value is not the appropriate standard to be applied to determine its value. What method should we use? I think we should be using the same before and after method. Why? Well, conservation easements are non-possessory partial interest in land, and the before and after method is the standard method by which all other non-possessory partial interests in land are valued for eminent domain purposes. Moreover, conservation easements are routinely valued for acquisition purposes, for purposes of calculating tax incentives or the purchase price and easement purchase programs, routinely valued using this before and after method. And considerations of fairness and equity mandate that a method no less favorable should be used to value easements on the back end upon condemnation. And finally, as we'll see in an example that I'll get to in a few minutes, the before and after method complies with the mandate of the Supreme Court in commodities trading that compensation be just or fair and equitable to all parties involved. But before we get to that example, we need to consider another eminent domain principle. It's the majority rule in this country that just compensation for the taking of property held subject to a restriction on its use is the property's unrestricted value. And as an example of this, in this 1994 Virginia Supreme Court case, the Department of Transportation, or VDOT, condemned a portion of land that was held in trust by the Fairfax County Park Authority, subject to a restriction that it be used as a public park. VDOT argued that just compensation for the taking of this land should be based on the value of the land as a public park or as open space, which VDOT estimated to be worth a whopping $2 per acre. The Park Authority obviously objected. It argued that just compensation should be based on the value of the land, assuming it was not subject to the use restriction. Basically, that its value should be based on its highest and best use for residential purposes, or $125,000 per acre. The Virginia Supreme Court held that the property should be valued assuming it was not subject to the use restriction, reasoning that the same principle should apply when determining fair market value for both eminent domain and real property taxation purposes. And then we have the case out of Ohio, Board of County Commissioners versus Thormeyer, where the Supreme Court of Ohio held that upon a highway department's condemnation of a portion of land that had been conveyed as a gift to the county to be used as a children's home, the county was entitled to compensation based on the unrestricted value of that land. The court explained that the donor had obviously imposed the use restriction primarily for the purpose of benefiting the occupants of the children's home. And, said the court, it could not be seriously suggested that if the donor had foreseen the condemnation, he would have wanted the condemning authority to benefit from the use restriction by being able to take the land for less than it's worth. In other words, the court in Thormeyer recognized that individuals who make gifts of property to be used for specific charitable purposes do not intend to thereby benefit condemning authorities by enabling them to take the property for less than its fair market value. So pursuant to this majority rule, this principle number two, the condemnation of property held subject to a restriction on its use should be viewed as involving a two-step process. The first step is removal of the restriction on the use of the property, followed by, in the second step, the taking of that newly unrestricted property by the condemning authority and the payment of just compensation for that unrestricted property. In other words, the value inherent in the right to use the property for purposes other than those specified should be viewed as having been conveyed to the government or the nonprofit entity, although that value lies dormant and inaccessible by the holder until the restriction on the use of the property is removed in the context of an eminent domain proceeding. And I think it's also important to note that property that's held by a government entity or a charitable organization subject to a restriction on its use is generally treated as being held in trust or quasi-trust for the benefit of the public, and when that property is condemned, the government entity or charitable organization is generally required to use the proceeds to accomplish a similar purpose in some other manner or location. So how does this second principle relate to conservation easements? Well, conservation easements are generally held by government entities or land trust subject to a restriction that they be used for a very specific charitable or public purpose, and that's the protection of the particular land they encumber for the conservation purposes specified in the deed. Because the holder of a conservation easement is generally not free to sell or otherwise transfer that easement, conservation easements are often described as having zero value in the hands of the holder. And in fact, they often impose a net financial burden on the holder due to the costs associated with their long-term monitoring and enforcement. As a result, some have suggested that conservation easements are worth nothing in the hands of the holder, and the holder should be entitled to nothing when the land encumbered by the easement is taken through condemnation. But of course, the zero value phenomenon is not particular to conservation easements. Any property that's held by a government entity or charitable organization subject to a restriction on its use has a significantly reduced or often zero value from the holder's perspective because it can't be freely sold or exchanged. And that was certainly the case in the Fairfax County and the Thormeyer situations. So the condemnation of a conservation easement should be understood as follows. The conservation easement is basically a restrictive covenant held by the land trust or the government entity subject to a restriction on its use. Pursuant to this second eminent domain principle, upon the condemnation of an easement, the use restriction is removed and the holder should be entitled to the unrestricted value of that easement. And then pursuant to the first principle that we discussed, because conservation easements or restrictive covenants are not bought and sold in open and competitive markets, the unrestricted value of the easement or the covenant should be determined using our before and after method. So now let's apply these principles to an example, the total taking of land encumbered by an easement. Let's assume a condemning authority condemns an entire parcel of land encumbered by an easement for use as part of an airport or perhaps a highway expansion. In this situation, the condemning authority would have to take both the encumbered land and the conservation easement, and it could either extinguish the easement, release it, or merge it with fee title to the land, thereby freeing that land to be used in manners formally restricted by the easement. Let's assume also that at the time of the condemnation, the fair market value of the land, if it were not encumbered by the easement, would be $5 million, but the fair market value of the land encumbered by the easement is $3 million. When a tract of land, the ownership of which is divided, such as in the case of an easement, when that tract of land is condemned, something known as the unit rule, also sometimes referred to as the undivided fee rule, is generally applied to determine the compensation payable to the various owners of interest in the land. The unit rule involves a two-step process. First, the property taken is valued as if it were owned by one person, that is, as if it were an undivided or unencumbered whole, and that amount constitutes the total compensation award. Then in the second step, that total compensation award is apportioned among the various owners of interest in the land in accordance with their respective rights. If the owners of the interest in the land have entered into a contract regarding the apportionment of this condemnation award, that contract will generally control. And in the absence of a contract, if one of the interests is an easement or a restrictive covenant, the before and after method is generally employed to determine the value of that easement or covenant for purposes of compensating its holder. So applying the unit rule to our example, the total compensation award would, of course, be $5 million, because that's the fair market value of the land as if it were an undivided or unencumbered whole. And in the second step, that total compensation award would be apportioned between the owner of the encumbered land and the holder of the easement in accordance with their respective rights. So what does this mean? Well, assuming no provision to the contrary in the easement deed, the owner of the encumbered land should receive the fair market value of his or her interest in that land, or $3 million. And the holder of the easement should receive the remaining $2 million, which is the value of the conservation easement as determined under the before and after method at the time of the condemnation. Pursuant to our second eminent domain principle, upon the condemnation of the easement, the holder should be entitled to the unrestricted value of that easement. In other words, the value inherent in the right to restrict the development and use of the land should be viewed as having been conveyed to the holder of the easement, although that value lay dormant and inaccessible by the holder until the restriction on the use of the easement is removed in the condemnation proceeding. And of course, pursuant to the first eminent domain principle, because easements, like covenants, are not bought and sold in open and competitive markets, the value inherent in the easement should be determined using our before and after method. Calculating and apportioning the condemnation award as recommended in this example would comply with the mandate of the Supreme Court in commodities trading that compensation be just or fair and equitable to all of the parties involved. The owner of the encumbered land would have no cause to complain. Why? Because the owner would be paid full fair market value for his property interest, which is the land encumbered by the easement, which is worth $3 million. The public, in its capacity as payer of the bill for the acquisition of the land, would also have no cause to complain because it would be required to pay only fair market value for the property interest that it acquires, which, of course, is the land unencumbered by the easement, worth $5 million. And the holder of the easement would receive the difference between those two values, or $2 million, on behalf of the public, which, of course, invested in and is beneficiary of the conservation and historic values that were formerly provided by the easement. And the holder should be required to use that $2 million to accomplish similar conservation purposes in some other manner or location. Now, calculating and apportioning this condemnation award as recommended in this example would also comport with the intent of all parties involved in the easement's creation. To paraphrase the Supreme Court of Ohio in Thormeyer, it cannot be seriously suggested that landowners who donate easements, land trusts and government agencies who acquire easement, or the public, which is investing enormous sums in conservation easements, it can't be seriously suggested that they intend to thereby benefit condemning authorities by enabling them to take the encumbered land for less than it's worth. In other words, it can't be seriously suggested that anyone intends, through the conveyance of a conservation easement, to make the encumbered land a cheap and therefore attractive target for condemnation. Now, what about partial takings of land encumbered by a conservation easement? A public utility's condemnation of a right-of-way to construct or enlarge transmission facilities is obviously a partial taking, because the utility is not taking the entire parcel of land. Well, in a partial taking situation, the goal is to compensate the owner or the owners of interest in that land for both the portion of the land that's actually taken and any incidental injury or damage to the remaining land. I don't have time to run you through a numerical example of a partial taking, but you should be aware that valuation in a partial taking situation involves the application of the same fundamental principles and the same two-step process that we just went through. So while different jurisdictions use different methods to determine the value of the portion of the land that's actually taken and any incidental injury or damage to the remaining land, regardless of the method that is used in the particular jurisdiction, the appraiser should apply the unit rule and assume the land is not encumbered by a conservation easement when it's determining those values in the first step of the process. And then in step two, that total compensation award should be apportioned among the owners of interest in the land in accordance with their respective rights. Only if you assume that the land is not encumbered by an easement in this first step will our total award reflect a decrease in the value of both the encumbered land and the value of the conservation easement as a result of the taking. Most of the development value associated with land that's encumbered by an easement will have been effectively conveyed to the holder of the easement. And to the extent a utility's taking of a right-of-way decreases the development value of the land, the holder of the easement should be compensated for that decrease. If we fail to compensate holders of easements for that reduction in the development value of the land, easement-encumbered land would become an attractive target for condemning authorities because similar but unprotected lands with their development rights intact would be much more expensive to condemn. And of course, that would be contrary to the strong public policy in favor of the use of conservation easements as a land protection tool. And with that, I'm going to turn the podium over to Daniel, who is going to open things up for questions.